Welcome once again to the Radio Conference Call, a podcast by radio people, for radio people, and for folks that just love entertainment, love music, and we welcome Northwest radio icon, Rockin' Rick Hansen. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Randy. Great to be here. I'm back on the podcast. Thanks for having me.
Also, Jim Valley, Jim with the Viceroys, Don of the Good Times, Paul Revere and the Raiders. Jim, it's a pleasure to make your acquaintance.
Thank you. You too, Randy.
Rick, you're going to be doing the heavy lifting on this outfit. Where do we start with a guy, a Northwest rock and roll icon like Jim Valley?
Well, we start with his recent, freshly off the road trip to Mossy Rock, Washington, which Jim
starting at the top.
Yeah. So what's very cool is that I've never known Jim up until about a month ago, but it feels like I've known him forever because he's such a great guy and we've got so much in common, and he's just a delight to know. So I start with that, and I guess what we should do, because Randy introduced you as a Northwest musical icon, and that is absolutely a great description, but let's start with that part of it. And then let's work our way to Mossy Rock.
Okay, so starting back in what, 55?
Oh, geez, let's not go that far.
Okay.
let's start with young Jim Valley, and much like radio guys who are listening to this, you two, and I think a lot of musicians, started with this vision of wanting to do something really bad, but not exactly knowing how to get there and where to go. But you were that kid, right? You were that young kid that wanted to play some rock and roll. Tell us how that all started.
I was saying 1955 when rock and roll came out, Rock Around the Clock, Bill Haley, Little Richard and all that. And I just turned my world around. And I couldn't stop my feet from moving. But anyway, in 58, in Jane Addams Junior High School, I was 15, I believe. And I was playing in a Glenn Miller kind of band. And we sat down and read charts, playing the trumpet. And then the first rock and roll band, one of the first rock and roll bands in Seattle, from Shoreline High School and Lincoln High School, came to Jane Addams. And they were called the Frantics. Actually, at that time, the Four Frantics, and electric guitar, Santa bass, Work With Me Annie, Honky Tonk. Anyway, I was like spun around like Mr. Toad, and I went up and said, you guys need a trumpet player? And so anyway, that got me really excited that I'd never seen it rock and roll played or, you know, in front of my very own eyes. So I was in junior high school. I wrote a song about a girl that was in my choir, and my next door neighbor said, hey, it's a great song. I think we should record it. Like, he knew what to do. Of course not. But anyway, he knew a friend that had a set of drums for Christmas, a guy that played the saxophone really, really great, and a guy that had a guitar in his house. He couldn't play it, couldn't tune it, was missing a couple strings, but he had a guitar. So they all came over to my house, and we kind of worked out a couple of arrangements for maybe three or four songs. The guitar haver just kind of beat on it. But anyway, we played at a intermission in Lake City, Washington, for a summer dance, and played these three songs. We called ourselves Vince Valley and His Chain Gang. And I got kind of nervous. My mouth got kind of dry, but we pulled it off. And later in the audience, somebody said, hey, Valley, how long have you been doing this? I said, oh, a little over a month. And he just kind of went, oh, didn't say, keep it up. Don't leave your tapes off. But I knew our band was a rock and roll band was lacking something, which was an electric guitar. So I had a summer job. I went down and was able to buy a guitar. And the other interesting thing about that is the store where I bought it was the same store or two blocks down from where Jimi Hendrix bought his guitar around the same time, same brand. And when you bought a guitar at that point in 58, you got a month's free lessons. Well, this guy was a country guy. And at that point, country and rock and roll were two different worlds. And this guy said, I'm going to learn you how to pick that thing, Vince. And I said, no, you're not. I'm going to go home and learn how to play like Elvis, who turned out to be a country guy. But anyway, I didn't accept the free lessons, and it went on from there.
Did Jimmy accept the free lessons, as far as you know?
Did Jimmy? I don't know. I don't know.
All right. So you were all of about like 15-ish or something like that?
Yeah, 15.
Yeah, yeah. So when did this mature into your first really well-known Northwest band called the Viceroys?
Well, that band there was the seeds of the Viceroys. And at that point, coming into 59, our folks moved and I changed high schools and met a guy that could play piano really great. And then another guy in my choir told me that his mom would buy him an electric bass if I could teach him how to play. And I said, absolutely. So I've been playing at least a month and a half. So I taught him how to play bass, bottom four strings of the guitar. And I think we became Jim Valley and the Viceroys. And then we weren't that great, so I didn't really want my name associated with the guys. And I said, let's just become the Viceroys. And that was just because of cigarettes. The Viceroys went with Valley, having nothing to do with Pat O'Day.
I was setting you up for that question. And us in radio love the lead. We called him the lead, Pat O'Day, because he was like the legendary dude in radio. But sometimes his stories got a little bit let's how we say inflated
or true. If it wasn't for Pat O'Day, the Beatles probably wouldn't have made it.
I'm thinking you're right.
Hey, Rick, we talked about Pat yesterday, and he never let the truth stand in the way of a good story.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. he verbalized to many of us over the years that the Viceroys took their name from the cigarette brand that he smoked. Is that any truth to that?
No. I didn't know he smoked Viceroys. But there was
that
a story.
So
there was a story. He had a character, Granny Peters. And in 63, when our group recorded a song called Granny's Pad, which was about our piano player's grandmother's house that he affectionately referred to as Granny's Pad. That's what that was about. But Pat always said, oh, they took their name from my character all the way, almost to the end of his life.
I would correct him
many, many times.
Well, as he once told a group of us, he said, when he wrote this book, there was all kinds of these great stories in his book, and some people called him on the value. Did not write a history book. I wrote a memoir.
My memory.
The distinction is, it's what I remember. Yes.
My alternate realities.
So, as people of radio here in the Great Pacific Northwest, at one point or another, knew the name. I mean, if you're old enough, the Viceroy, and. At one point, there was something that Pat O'Day and I think Dick Curtis was involved too in a thing called the Teen Spectacular at the Seattle Center. And the Viceroys were, because they were kind of the house band in all those dance clubs. You know, we're talking about the Spanish Castle, Parker's, Pearls in Bremerton, the Linwood Rollaway. All of those were kind of on this dance circuit. What was the other one, Jim?
The Target Ballroom in West Seattle.
The Target Ballroom. So you were in that circuit, and you were one of the key bands that floated around all of those places, along with some other Northwest bands. But you were asked by O'Day to step in as musicians for the national acts that he brought to the Teen Spectacular. Is that correct?
Well,
tell me who of those were.
Well, it was actually called. Where we played for it was called the Spring Spectacular. It was at the Opera House. It was in three, and that's when Granny's Pad came out. So we had a local hit record, and we backed April and Nino, April Stevens, Nino Temple, Little Eva, Ray Stevens, Freddie Cannon. Gosh, I can't remember who else, but you know, we had a, you know, five or six acts that we, you know, got down to learn their records, and the Beach Boys were the headliners, who were in 63, you know, Round, Round, Get Around, or I Get Around, and Don't Worry. I mean, incredible. They were just amazing. Brian was still with them, of course. But at the last minute, sort of, like maybe a month before, this little guy from Detroit had this song called Fingertips. And he was like a kind of a junior Ray Charles. Blind little Stevie Wonder was added to the show. And we were told that, but, you know, he would have his own band. Okay, great. So we get to the rehearsal place at the Opera House, and we're starting to rehearse with the different solo performers and so on. And all of a sudden, in comes Stevie Wonder with his drummer and his road manager. And they look at us, and we're like, you know, homogenized white guys from North Seattle. And they look at us and they say, "You're not backing him." I said, "Well, we weren't supposed to back him. You know, you're supposed to have his own band." "Well, we're going to go find us a band." So then they split, and we're going, okay, fine. And the show starts, and we do our part and back all these people. The Beach Boys come on. The kids are just going wild and crazy. It was like pre-Beatle, but they were just going nuts. And then the curtain closes, and then from the backstage door in comes Stevie with his drummer and a saxophone player and a trumpet player, and the road manager looks at me and says, "Okay, you're backing him." So without any rehearsal we backed him. But I mean, he did three songs, and Fingertips, you know, has two chords, bom 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 bom, so that was fairly easy. And then we did Bring It On Home to Me, which was a classic song, and Hallelujah by Ray Charles, which we also knew. So we were able to go out and back this. I was telling you, Rick, if someone could have taken a picture of us backing up this little guy, 13 years old, dark glasses with his harmonica in front of his face, I would give my left, I'd give one of them to this.
Wow, what a great story. So, and Stevie Wonder, you're saying he's a teenager. At that point, not huge, but getting there. I love this story. We're bold enough to say, "Hey, you want to go to lunch?"
Right. I mean, what does that tell you about my set? I said, could I take him to lunch? Because it was right by the food circus where I used to work during the World's Fair for a while. And the guy just said, "Okay, put your arm out like this." He takes your arm, "Be back in an hour." So we walked over to the food circus, and we're having lunch, and two teenage guys come up and say, recognize me, and say, "Hey, we want your autograph." So he pulls out a card out of his pocket with his picture and Stevie Wonder in Braille. Now, what an amazing souvenir that would be, but not for them. They wanted him to autograph it. And I said something like, "Come on, give us a break. We're just having lunch here." And Stevie says, I'll sign it. And so he takes that card and, you know, blindfolded, he signs his name. And then he looks at me and he says, "My mama always taught me to be kind to everyone."
Wow.
And that's his charisma. He still is that way.
Yep. Fantastic. I would have liked to have had a little microphone at that lunch table and have that as a souvenir myself. That would have been a great conversation to be ears dropping on or eavesdropping on. So that's cool. So the Viceroy's, the Spring Spectacular, and then time goes on. By the way, you guys were not only, you had Granny's Pad out, and then you did Return to Granny's Pad.
Going back to Granny's.
Oh, going back to Granny's. Okay.
Yeah. And it became number one, but it was a highly forgettable song. I mean, most people don't remember that.
they were both instrumentals, right? There was no lyrics.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Granny's Pad had a little talking thing like, come on down to Granny's Pad. Granny do the Watusi. Yada, yada, yada.
if we're lucky, Randy will be able to find a little slice that we can slip into the show to remind people that are people that never heard it, get a little taste for what Granny's Pad was all about.
Well, I've got a little taste of it right now if you want me to kind of put it on real quick.
That's good.
Hey, I'm just a listener.
It's on vinyl. Just a little taste there of Granny's Pad.
All right.
That's cool.
I'd buy it.
So the saxophone was a huge part of the Viceroys.
Well, the saxophone was really a huge part of most of the rock and roll bands in Seattle. I mean, with the Frantics, Dave Lewis combo, the Dynamics with Jeff Aptom, and even the Wailers had a saxophone player. Didn't play a lot, but that saxophone vibe was in there.
And what about Merrily and the Turnabouts with Neil, you know?
Neil was the saxophone player,
yeah,
correct?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he later became one of the Wailers.
He did?
And
wow.
Merrily Rush, she and I went to high school together, and her name was, before she married Neil, was Merrily Gunst, and a little bit slim, kind of scrawny almost, but she was a singer and started playing with, I'm not sure what band, but she eventually became Merrily and the Turnabouts, and Neil was part of that, and she married that guy, took his name.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, that, so did this group of, you just named several of the band, the Northwest bands that were just like household names at the time. Did you kind of hobnob with all those folks? Did you know them, or
we knew them, but you know, you met them sometimes if they had battles of the bands. The Dynamics for a while, before Larry Coryell, who became, you know, a world famous jazz guitarist from Eastern Washington, joined them. They wanted me to join them early on, and I decided to, for some reason, to stay with the Viceroys. But yeah, I knew them. They were great. Pete Borg, the bass player, went to high school with me.
And just about every weekend, were all the bands kind of busy doing something somewhere?
I think so. I mean, because there were high school dances, PTA dances. There were sorority high school fraternity dances before radio got into it. Like with, I think they first got into it with the Linwood Rollaway Skating Rink, and they'd advertise these dances, and all of a sudden they become, wow, if you're not there, the world will not turn for me. One of my favorite memories was early in, I think, 59, I think it was a sophomore, and I went to see Linwood Rollaway. They had Little Bill and the Blue Notes, the Frantics, and Dave Lewis. Little Bill and the Blue Notes had Rockin' Robin before he joined the Wailers. And just, I screamed. I mean, he was just like Little Richard and Elvis together. So it was an amazing scene that happened from like 60, 61, 62, whatever.
Cool. We do have, I think, and again, I'll allow you to edit this in, Randy, but I think there's a little clip of one of those dance spots that talked about, I think it was Dick Curtis that voiced him and talked about all of the dance action that weekend. Didn't, in this particular cut that I was able to find, There wasn't no mention of the Viceroys in that particular one, but you'll get a flavor for, you know, what kind of excitement was built around the teen dance clubs of the day. So,
all right, here's the Dick Curtis dance party spot. It was, Rick, this was on KJR, right?
KJR, and I think, yeah, I don't know if any of the other stations ever played him. Probably not, but it was definitely on KJR for sure.
All right, here it is.
Hello, everybody. This is Dick Curtis with that dance lineup for the weekend. Now, tonight at the Target Ballroom in Darien, we're having... Hello, everybody. This is Dick Curtis with that dance lineup for the weekend. Now, tonight at the Target Ballroom in Darien, we're happy to say that the Bandits return to the Target Ballroom tonight in what has to be a big South End dance. Everyone is at the Target Ballroom. You can't miss the wild, wild sound of the Bandits. Better than ever tonight, returning to the Target Ballroom in Darien. Now, tonight, Burlington Rollerball in person, a Liverpool 5 tonight. Burlington Rollerball in a giant summer dance night from Mount Vernon. Liverpool 5 tonight. Tomorrow night, Birch Bay's Village West with the Liverpool 5 in person at Birch Bay. Don't miss seeing the Liverpool 5. They are fantastic. Lundy's at Lake Stevens tomorrow night. A big dance night as the Dynamics return to Lundy's at Lake Stevens. The Dynamics are back for that dance for Everett in Sahomish County. And a wild night it always is on Saturday nights. Tomorrow night, Lundy's with the Dynamics back. Monday night, attention east side, Lake Hills Roller Rink. The Viceroys return to Lake Hills. The Viceroys are finally back to Lake Hills Roller Rink. It's a Monday night dance you can't miss.
Boy, talk about building the excitement for a big rock and roll teen dance party. Dick knew how to do it.
I know. I know. And anybody who was anybody went to those dances, that's for sure. So the Viceroys, gosh, what a great story that is. But wait, you left the Viceroys because you found another opportunity you thought maybe work out better for you. Tell us about
that,
Jim.
Let me back up a little bit. The Viceroys, when Granny Smith became a hit, at one point we were asked to play in Seaside, Oregon, which was another state, which was wow, and a place called the Pipo Club. We were supposed to have 800 kids, and we get down there, and we're getting a percentage of the door, and we have 80 kids. Oh, wow. Well, where are the rest of the kids? Well, they're up in Cannon Beach. There's this new group out of Portland. They wore three-cornered hats. The kids love them. They're called Paul Revere and the Raiders. And I went, God, what a cool name is that. And so within a week or two, I'm back up in Seattle, and I get a call from Pat O'Day, who we are scheduled to play at the Spanish Castle. And Paul and Pat says, listen, Jim, I got a date on this group from Portland. They're called Paul Revere and the Raiders. Would you share the night with them? I said, absolutely. And I was smart enough or intuitive enough to go. We would go first. And that's when I first met them. And it was like, wow, they were so much fun. They were playing like 3-4 chord rock and roll, oop, oop, a doo kind of music. And just, you know, three steps above any other Northwest groups. I mean, they were professional. They were just, Paul Revere was just like the George Burns of rock and roll, and Mark Lindsay was a hot soul singer. They didn't play too many notes, just played, you know, what they need. Anyway, and that's where I first met them, and I said to Paul, if you ever need a guitar player, let me know. And so we became friends during that summer as we played some dances together, and he set us up for an audition in San Francisco, North Beach, the Peppermint Tree. And we passed the audition and with a girl named Nancy Clare that was our singer, who was just like a Etta James. And so we played there for like 4 weeks that December, I guess it was the end of 64. And that's where my life kind of changed a little bit, if we wanted to go into that.
Yes, we do. We want to know how your life changed.
Okay. Well, I was reading my comic books. No, I was one afternoon, the bouncer, there were three guys that were very cool and somehow knew stuff that most normal people didn't know. And this guy takes me for a walk, and then we go up to see his apartment, and astrology charts, numerology charts, you know, perfume charts, books, just really, really neat. I mean, like I'd never seen an apartment. And so he sat me down and told me some philosophy concerning a book called In Search of the Miraculous, which was written by a guy named Ouspensky, who was a disciple of a guy from Russia, and his name was Gurdjieff. And there was quite a following of Gurdjieff. And the concept was, most of us are asleep. We need to wake up. We're in the basement of our consciousness, which is the first time I heard consciousness as a word. It was like, you're either conscious or you're unconscious. But he went on to say the doors of perception and this and that. And he said, and Gurdjieff, you know, says there's certain substances that you can use that will open up these doors. And one is called marijuana. Would you like to try some? And I went, yes. And, you know, I had gone to 2 years of college. I knew if you tried this stuff, you'd be a heroin addict. So it was dead against what I ever thought I'd ever try to do. But I did. And, you know, I got a little tickle on the inside, and the world changed. And it started me on the inward path.
Very interesting. And so that was, and that was, you know, that kind of movement was birthed out of the San Francisco area, right? And so there you were amongst all of that, and you got a taste of it. That's very cool that you were, you know, that you were, not that you were smoking marijuana necessarily, but that you were a part of all that, which was going on everywhere and all around you at the time.
Yeah, and the Viceroy thought I was nuts, you know, because I wanted to share it with them. No, you're going to go to jail. And then within a month, I've come back, and we come back to Seattle, and they called me up and said, can you get us some of that?
So then, but you didn't jump right into working with Paul Revere. You kind of developed a relationship during that summer, but the next step was a wonderful band that was kind of a stage band as well as, you know, great musicians, and it was Dawn and the Good Times. So how did that go about?
Well, you come back to Dick Curtis again, and Dick Curtis was advertising a dance at Parker's Ballroom, and a new band out of Portland. They're wilder and crazier than Paul Revere and the Raiders. They're called Dawn and the Good Times. You got to see it. You got to see it. So I went out to take a look, and they were great. They wore top hats, and they did some great routines and steps. And their lead singer, you know, I fell in love with. I thought he was an amazing singer. Don Gallucci was a keyboard player who was at the Kingsmen earlier, who taught them Louie Louie. But anyway, they asked me if I knew a guitar player that could sing. Their guitar player, Pete Ouellette, amazing guitarist, but he was a little stiff on stage. And they asked me if I knew anybody that could play a guitar and sing. And I said, I'll think about it. Not for me, but for maybe someone that might join that group. And that night I was tossing and turning, if you know what I mean. And I called him up the next day and I said, I found a guitar player. Who is it? It's me. You'd leave the Viceroy's to join Don the Good Times? You bet. And I just felt that what I had going for me at that point, a lead singer, and with Don McKinney, we could be like the Righteous Brothers, and we could be wild and crazy. Then I wrote a song for them called Little Sally Tease, which became a giant hit in the Northwest.
Yeah. So this is kind of a question, but are many of the folks from the Viceroy's and Don and the Good Times still with us? Are many of them gone or?
Still with us? Well, Mike Rogers was the saxophone player, later to become organ player. He's gone. He passed away, I don't know, in the late 80s or early 90s. But as far as the rest of them, I think they're all with us.
Oh, good. Okay. That was my next question, too. So is there a reunion of old musicians that get together and have lunch or anything?
Well, not so much. Not so much. I mean, the Viceroy's, that I left them and they were kind of upset with me and whatever. So it's taken a while to kind of heal things. But the guitar player that took my place in the Viceroy's, his name was Greg Beck, and we both went to Shoreline. I played in the group for 6 years. He played in the group, I think, for another 4 or 5 years. And then in 1972, when I had come back to Seattle after being in L.A. for like 3 years, I formed a group with a guy named Andy Parepa, who was with the Sonics, the Witch, and you remember that, that song.
Oh, yeah.
That group. Oh, yeah.
We formed a group called Sweet Talkin' Jones, and Greg Beck became the guitar player. So Greg and I played in a group and as a duo for the next couple of years.
Interesting. It's so great to see how all of these kind of names and figures interact with one another through that era. And much like radio, you know, radio guys, one way or the other end up knowing each other or connecting in some way or another with all the other guys. It's an old group of radio guys that get together once a year and have lunch. But there's a camaraderie. And that's kind of what brought my question. I didn't know if there was a similar thing going on in your world.
Dick Curtis, let me just bring him up. He was just one of the best. And he has a kind of a memoir that I don't think it's ever come out as a book, but he was a great guy. And we've been friends over the years. And for a long time, Merrily Rush and Dick and I and Nancy Clare would get together up in wherever he lived, up in Issaquah. And he's just passed, I think, this last year, but what a great soul.
Yeah, you were pretty close friends with him through all these years up until his death, isn't that
right? Yeah.
And I think many of the people listening to this would know or have interacted or engaged in work or whatever with Dick Curtis along the way. So that's kind of a cool connection. So John of the Good Times, top hats. You went from top hats to three-cornered colonial hats. How did that happen?
By this time, I know we're
there. Was there more marijuana involved?
No. In fact, I'll tell you that story if you like. But anyway, we were playing, the Good Times were playing the Portland Teen Fair, which was kind of a big deal. And during the afternoon, we're doing our set, in come the Raiders, and they were filming. They had just filmed Where the Action Is someplace. And as they come in, and I've got my top hat on, and the night before, my hair had been blonded by this beautician, and he looks at me and he says, "Harpo." And I said, "Yeah, okay. And then around that time, or maybe months later, Drake Levin, the Raider guitarist, gets drafted, and Revere called me up and wanted to know if I wanted to join him. And I said, "You know, I love you guys, but I really love Don and the Good Times, and we're so close to making it. We've been signed with Dunhill Records and yada, yada, yada." And he gave me the pep talk, and a lot of bands get this close and never make it. "You've already made it. You know, you'll make X amount of dollars. We'll record your songs. We like you as a songwriter and a stage performer and a guitarist." So talking it over with the Good Times, we all decided maybe I should go for it. So I did. And that's how I joined the Raiders. And when I did, this little side story that he made me promise that there would be no drugs involved. And I had to make I said, "Okay, fine." And I could do that. And that night when I flew down to L.A. and was spending the night with Mark, or stayed for a while with Mark Lindsay, there's a phone call. And it turns out it's Drake Levin's girlfriend. And they say, "Just tell Mark you're coming up to see a girlfriend." So I come out of the house and walk up the street, and here's Drake. And we get we go to his house and sitting around a circle with a few people. And he takes out a bag, he rolls a doobie and hands it to me. And I said, "You know, I promised Revere I wouldn't do this." And he said, "Oh, it's cool. We all make that promise, everyone in the band. We put a towel by the motel room door.
Oh, geez.
And you just have to be cool." And I went, "Wow, that's great." So my abstinence lasted like little, almost a day.
Oh, that's a great story. I love that. So what became kind of your MO, first with the Don and the Good Times and then with Paul Revere, is that both bands were show bands. They were stage entertainment, not just great musicians, and but you were fun performers. You did dance steps, you did crazy antics. Tell us a little bit about how a musician kind of makes that step into more show busy kind of stuff like that.
Well, I mean, the Viceroys, we did steps. just kind of left to right, maybe once in a while, basically left to right, sometimes right to left. But the good times, you know, they were doing, you know, lots of great steps, and took a while to learn them. But like I say in the beginning, I love to dance as much as I love to sing and play. So dancing was just second nature to me, and playing and dancing and all that. I mean, the first time I joined the Raiders, the first concert was down in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And the band was a little nervous because we only had one rehearsal during that 2 weeks time that I came down to learn. I mean, I played with the bass player. I played with Drake, the guitar player. Paul Revere kind of taught me the Raider Pony, their kind of essential dance step. But I never really had a rehearsal until right before the first performance. And there was a in front of the stage was at a cow palace, like, and, you know, bars and the, and, you know, so you wouldn't fall off. Anyway, I hung on these bars upside down and did my Louie Louie solo.
And, oh, man.
And the band went, wow. And Paul said, the kid's all right. And, you know, like a day later, he said, okay, you're in for good. Because I was told that I should take a sabbatical from the good times and play with them for 40 days. If the band liked it, I'd stay for 6 months. If the fans liked me, you know, reacted to me more than Drake, then I was in it for good. But after 3 days, Paul said, you're here for good. We love it. We've never sounded as good, felt as good, yada, yada, yada. So there I was.
Wow. And opened up all kinds of new opportunities, because now you're a national rock and roll act with fans across the country, across the globe. And TV became a big part of what you did with Paul Revere and the Raiders, right?
Right. Where the action is, right off the bat, that they had done that show for maybe half a year. And so, you know, daily exposure, Harpo, the kids. And at one point I mouthed, I love you, to the audience, because I was kind of a flower children kind of thing. And the camera caught me, and the director said, let's let that be your shtick. And so every time the camera would come in, I'd mouth, I love you. And then and then about a month or so later, we're in some huge, huge venue, like 10,000 kids. And it's time, I would do one song per show. They'd say, oh, you want to, should we let Harpo sing a song? And of course they wanted to have me sing, because, you know, they were hearing Mark Lindsay and Fang sang. So right before I started to sing, I went out in front of the microphone right at the edge of the stage, unfolded my arms, and did a great big, I love you. And they all went nuts. And Paul went, holy shit, what's going on here?
Gosh. Wow. Where the Action Is was a daily show. It's a Dick Clark, right? Dick Clark was the host.
Right.
Was it every day of the week?
Yeah, 5 days a week. When they're in different localities at maybe different times. It was
It was independent. It wasn't a network show. It was something that
right. Even though it was ABC.
And Paul Revere and the Raiders became kind of the house band. You were on.
Yeah, they got to be the house band. And the show made them, you know, help get them famous. And then in turn, they became the focal point why a lot of kids watch that show.
Yeah. It was mutually beneficial. So Paul Revere and the Raiders, you were there during the hottest period of existence, really.
Yeah, I was there during their heyday.
Yep. Hungry. What were some of the Kicks? Oh, yeah.
Kicks. Great Airplane Strike, which wasn't that giant of a hit, but it was a pretty hot song. But let's see, what else? Him or Me, What's It Gonna Be?
Ups and Downs.
Ups and Downs, one of my favorites. We did that on the Smothers Brothers.
Yeah, what was that like?
Pardon me?
What was that like? That's a huge show.
Oh, it was amazing. I mean, Carl Reiner was on there, and Barbara Eden, and they did kind of a Revolutionary War thing, or, you know, Barbara Eden was getting, trying to buy material from Carl Reiner, who was a fabric salesman. He had a special on if you bought red material and blue material, and you'd throw in these stars for free. But I had a little interaction with him. I was playing kind of backstage with the guitar by myself, and he walked by and he says, "Ah, having a moment with yourself, eh?" And then he went on to say how important it was for us to spend time alone from time to time and this and that. But he was just a remarkable, beautiful, majestic, humble sort of a guy.
Really? That's very cool. You were on Milton Berle as well. So there was some national television exposure during all of this, as well as where the action is. I think I saw or read somewhere that you had over 700 appearances on television during your time there.
Over what?
Over 700 television appearances.
Yeah, I think that Phil Volk, I think he probably got that out there. And that might be a little bit of an exaggeration, but it's probably close.
Yeah. So then your time with Paul Revere comes to an end. And tell us how that happened. What was the next step?
Well, the next step is we were getting ready to do a 60-day tour. And we went to a place, I think, called the Hullabaloo Club in Hollywood to rehearse. And we're getting ready to rehearse. And Mark says, I want to do Little Girl in the Fourth Row, which was the song he wrote, which was kind of, you know, are you kidding me? It's a slow song, Little Girl in the Fourth Row. And I said, I don't think we should do that song. I think that's a bullshit song. And Mark said, hey, Harpo, you're new. You can't say that. And I said, no, I'm not. I've been here a year. And I said, we're a group now. And I think all of our, you know, all of our intentions should be on the same page or just looking toward what is good for this group. And then all of a sudden, an argument broke out with the whole band. It was like a, you know, a tavern bar back in the 1800s where all of a sudden everybody started fighting. And I was kind of
literally
the catalyst.
Physically fighting?
I moved back. No, they weren't, no fisticuffs, but they were just yelling. And at one point, Paul yelled the loudest and said, okay, stop the music. Everyone's going out to have lunch by themselves. And then we're coming back here, and then we're going to talk about this. So we came back an hour later, and Paul brought up that he wanted the same promise from everyone that they wouldn't, you know, use any drugs. And he asked Mark, and Mark said, oh, yeah, I can do that, boss. No problem. And then he asked me, and I said, you know, it's not really – it's like I'm not protesting naked around the neighborhood or anything. And it kind of calms me a little bit. And I think it helps in songwriting. And the rest of the other two guys, no, let's talk about this later. And I said, Paul, if you need to find someone who doesn't, you know, use this, then you should. And then all of a sudden the practice broke up. We practiced. And about a week later, Paul said, well, have you changed your mind? I said, no. Have you changed your mind? No. Okay. Well, then we're going to have you go out on the 60-day tour, and at the end of it, by that time, we'll find another guitar player. I said, okay, that's great. Because it was a long tour, it would kind of set me up financially a little bit. And then 2 days before the tour, Paul called and said, well, we talked to our business managers, and we've decided to hire Drake back, because he's out of the service now, for this tour. But you'll do 3 dates with us. And the last date was in Seattle. And he went, well, that's just great. So that's how that happened.
Hey, Jim, were you with the Raiders for Indian Reservation or no?
No, that was kind of an interesting story, too. That there was a group out of L.A. that recorded that song in 66, and it was just a local hit. And later, like in 1969-70, Mark had done... Two solo records that were both hits, and he decided to work on that song. So he took that same arrangement, you know, beefed it up with some strings or whatever, and it was going to be originally released as Mark Lindsay, but someone upstairs in Columbia said, let's release this by the Raiders. They haven't had a hit for a while, and they did it and became their swan song. It became a number one song, And it's the last time the Raiders were a happening, you know, recording group. Nothing ever happened after that.
Yeah, it was a real strange departure from what they were known for. But it, like you say, it was a shit. So more power to them. But it was, you know, it was kind of a odd lyrics, you know, really, for a pop band to be singing. And
right. But I can't remember who wrote that, but it was quite a famous songwriter.
Yeah. Interesting. So at that point, I'm not quite sure where the Laurel Canyon piece of your life comes in. Was that post Paul Revere?
Well, it was during and post. I mean, I lived in, when I first moved in with to LA, I lived in Paul Revere's house, his former house in Burbank. And then I moved to Laurel Canyon. And there were two houses. One house I rented for a while, which was amazing, which was Greta Garbo's first mansion.
Huh.
And it was rented by a guy that was connected with the Mamas and Papas. And so, and through him, I met Denny Doherty, who became a dear friend. And then later I moved to another house up further in Laurel Canyon, which was a magic house too. And I was there, you know, with the Raiders after I left the Raiders for about a year. But it was an incredible neighborhood, Laurel Canyon.
That was, for those who are tuning into this episode, if you have not watched the documentary called Echo in the Canyon, you absolutely got to watch that, because it talks about all the amazing people that were there, kind of the vibe that was going on in Laurel Canyon, just out of LA. Jackson Browne was there. Like you say, the Mamas and Papas, Stephen Stills, the Byrds, the Beach Boys, Buffalo Springfield. It was kind of the explosion of pop folk music with this group of artists. And you were right there with them.
Yeah. In fact, Jackson Browne, I met Jackson Browne not too long after I joined the Raiders. Terry Melcher, Doris Day's son, who was the producer of the Raiders and the Byrds, produced a group called the Gentle Soul. And they were a group of, you know, flower children musicians. And Jackson was a member of them for a while. And I met him through them. And we sat in a bedroom once on a mattress on the floor and shared songs. And his songs just totally inspired me. I mean, from three chord songs to kind of folky, beautiful storytelling songs. And his voice was gorgeous. And that was 67. I think his first album, Doctor My Eyes, maybe came out in 70, 71. I'm not sure, but he definitely changed my songwriting style and my direction in music.
Hmm. Very, very interesting stuff here for sure. Plus, I don't want to get away from talking about Mossy Rock, because that brings us back to something that you engaged in shortly after, well, a while after Paul Revere and the Raiders, and that was this amazing engagement with young people and introducing music and movement to little folks. How did that all get started? You call it Planet Rainbow.
Rainbow Planet.
Rainbow Planet. Yep, yep. Tell us the story.
Okay, 1980, I was asked by an administrator in Tacoma Schools if I wanted to come and work with gifted kids and do some sessions. I said, absolutely, sure. And so I came down, and that was Carl DeLaccio, who was the husband of the photographer that took pictures of the Raiders and the Whalers and the Good Times and Merrily and all that. Anyway, I started this job in Tacoma Schools, and I had a high school. I lightly turned them high school rock and roll choirs in each of the high schools. And we met one day in an enrichment class after school. And at one point I said, God, I'd love to work with some younger kids. So Carl set up assemblies for me in elementary schools. And really because of those assemblies and music and movement with those young kids, a reporter from the local newspaper did a nice article. They called me the Pied Piper of school town. And because of that article, an administrator in a different school system called me up the very next day and asked me if I'd be interested in maybe writing a song that would help their kids learn to get along. I said, yeah, for sure, I could do that. So I used Buckminster Fuller's idea of the spaceship Earth or spaceship Earth and called us the Rainbow Planet. We all ride the same spaceship. We can learn to get along as easy as we sing this song. It was kind of a 60s, 80s rock and roll Chuck Berry kind of song. And it worked. And one administrator in a different school heard it before I introduced it. And he said, could you slip our slogan in, our school slogan? And there were a multicultural lot of Latino kids. And their slogan was, I'm special, you're special, we are special together. And if you did an assembly at their school, at the very end, they stand up and they point at themselves and they go, I'm special, you are special, we are special together. So I put it in this song and it became kind of one of the keys that really, I think, translated and got parents and teachers, as well as kids, interested in the work I was doing with kids. So that became a workshop that I did in this one school for a month, and then other schools heard about it, and pretty soon it became my job. And for a while, for like 4 years, I was around the Tacoma, Seattle area, Bellingham a little bit, Olympia. And then at one point, a school in Spokane heard about it. They flew me over there, which I thought was pretty cool, and did a school a day. And this teacher that brought me over there was part of a national organization called Math Their Way. And they had me come down to Santa Cruz for a national teacher principal conference. And I was their song and dance guy. And then they all saw the work that I was doing. And by this time, too, I'm taking kids' poems and setting them to songs. So I'm teaching friendship, in a sense, according to kids. Like the friendship train has come to town, put on a smile, drop that frown, reach out, jump up, touch the sky. It was like their lyrics, their fresh imaginations that I get to collaborate with, which was an amazing, amazing, situation for me.
So then started happening nationally.
So then, after that conference in Santa Cruz, the next year I'm going to New Hampshire, Connecticut, Texas, Florida, California, Chicago. And then that's in like maybe 85 or something like that, or 87. I don't know. Then the next thing that happens is I get a letter from a school in Rio de Janeiro, international schools. And one of their teachers there had been in Tacoma, knew of the work I was doing, and wrote and said, would you consider coming this far? And I considered it for like 3 seconds. And my response was yes. And so that started me into international schools. And there's a connection between international schools of, besides the teachers and, moving from school to school, they have different conferences in this neck of the woods and this neck of the woods. And they're kind of up on what's going on. So I was invited to a conference in Singapore where there were schools from China and Japan, Thailand, Saudi Arabia, India. So before then, I'd worked in schools in South America for like a couple of 3 years, and then China hopped on, and then this other conference, and then the next thing I know, I'm going to all these schools, Indonesia, Thailand, China, Japan. So it became a very international, beautiful thing.
So that became your life purpose, your life mission for the past 30 years-ish, right?
Right, right.
Yeah.
To show children friendships through music and song, because I believe we're all singers. I think all of us love to sing, even though we're shy about it. But if we can get over that shyness, and one of the gifts that some teachers that I had was being a role model to make kids feel comfortable in a group singing.
Mm. I encourage anyone that's and dancing, lots of movement. I encourage anyone to take there's a YouTube video up on Rainbow Planet. Just hit the search bar and you'll see this great interaction going on with Tim and with all these kids. The whole room is like brimmed with uplifting, fun music and great dance moves. And it really is inspiring for sure. So, that is a key part of what you've been doing. But you now, as of recently, have organized a new group.
I do. I have a group called the Jim Valley Project. There are four of us, and we do a lot of my original songs, but a lot of kind of 60s orientated stuff like Sultans of Swing. We do a couple of Beatles songs. We do a few Raiders songs, but harmony. I play keyboard mostly, but I play keyboard and guitar, and it's really been fun.
So what kinds of venues are you doing? Like, is it bars and that kind of thing?
We're doing like coffee houses. We're doing like local festivals for right now. But as time goes on, I have a national contact that wants to get us into national stuff, it'd be an opening act for, somebody else more famous than me.
If they can find somebody more famous
than you. I think they can.
What are some of the dates you have coming up, and where will you be?
Well, I can't tell you right now. We're gonna be in Bainbridge Island. We're gonna do a special event in Gig Harbor. It's called the Americana Festival in August. But I can let you know. You can go on jimvalley.com, and you could see, where we're going to be at.
Fantastic.
Yeah, that would be the best. Wow. So this has been It's been an hour of nothing but great stories and fun with Jim. Randy, I've exhausted my questions, and I think I even know Jim better than I knew him the last time I interviewed him. So do you have anything that you're wanting to ask?
Well, yeah, I guess, getting back to the Viceroy's Dawn of the Good Times, and, that moment when you knew you made it when you heard your song on KJR, what was that like?
Oh, I almost drove off the side of the road. It was like, we had recorded this song in a little studio, I think mono, and we thought it was cool, but I said, I don't think it sounds like it's something on the radio. And KJR had a Battle of the New Sounds, and it finally slipped its way on there, and it won for like a week in a row, and Pat had to finally chart it. But yeah, it was exciting. All of a sudden, we were somebody. We were contenders.
I could have been a contender.
Were there any other radio guys that you got close to during that era?
Yeah, Tom Murphy became a great friend. Lan Roberts was just a wonderful, funny guy. And we used to spend some time together. Dick Curtis, of course. Who else is there? Larry Luchak.
Yeah. That's
what I remember. I mean, I'm going to be 80 next year. I'm just a kid, but I'm still going to be 80.
So, getting back to the radio thing, Jim, did you guys do the radio interview circuit when you went to L.A. or Chicago to play in any of your groups?
You mean the Viceroy's or the Good Times or the Raiders?
Any and all.
Well, the Raiders, they were set. I mean, yeah, the radio stations felt really lucky that if we could come in and say a few words, which we didn't do that much. Dawn of the Good Times, maybe just local, but not really. Not that I remember.
Ray Canson, Jim Valley, thank you guys so much. What great stories, Jim, and continued success to you and with your group. And we'll look forward to maybe you getting to Wenatchee one of these days.
Randy lives in Wenatchee.
Oh, Randy. I wasn't sure who was talking to who. Yeah, sure. Wenatchee. Sounds great.
We have good apples over here, Jim.
I've heard that. you're kind of close to Lake Chelan. That's the big city over there, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, Wenatchee, East Wenatchee, and then you have Chelan and Manson. It's gorgeous. We'd love to have you over here sometime.
I'd love to come.
Well, and again, continued success, Rick. Thanks for doing the heavy lifting this afternoon. We appreciate that. And
sure.
Hey, love you guys, and God bless you both. Thanks for taking time on the radio conference call.
All right. Thank you again. Bye-bye.